Hi, greetings everyone. I'm Kathy Malloy. Manju Rampasad and I are delighted to introduce Patricia Meering. She's an organization development consultant, a member of the European Organization Design Forum, and a newly minted PhD from Middlesex University in the UK. And she comes to us with a really interesting case study of complex alliances and conflict in a large-scale, multicultural global project. So ODF's community engagement and learning team thought that this would be a really great opportunity to explore the possible impacts of national culture and issues on global organization design and development. So we invite you to join Patricia in a hands-on exploration. This is about exploration of this case during the next hour, and you're going to be working in some breakout groups. So she's very familiar with the case. She's been involved in it, but she's not coming to you with all the answers. She's asking you to put on your exploration hat and share your perspective and your lens to help her think through the situation she's about to present. So welcome, a warm welcome to Patricia Meering from the UK.
Thank you so much, Kathy. And I know a couple of people here. I think I know Mike. So hi, Mike, but a pleasure to meet everybody else. And I'm just going to share my screen quick. There we go. So the first question I'd love for you to write down in the chat is, which national cultures do you identify with? Personally, so I was born in South Africa, but my parents are both Rhodesian. That's formerly Zimbabwe. One of the parents is Irish and the other parents is French and Swiss. So I kind of, from all my readings, kind of identify with a number of different national cultures. So I'd love to find out, yeah, what national culture you come from. So I can't see in the chat, but I guess, Manju, if you can let me know.
Yes, we have people coming from North America, Southern Europe, Italy. I'm from India. Then there is USA, Ireland. Then the Greg just mentioned the boring Middle American culture, the US culture.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone. And we are going to run a poll quickly.
Sure.
And the poll, Tanya, if you could put up the poll. The question is around using a value-based or national cultural values-based framework in your work. So if you can tell me if you've ever done this before. Is the poll up there?
Trying to get it launched. My internet is.
If anybody wants to say yay or nay, happy for you to just give me some background if you have used one before. Kathy has. I see a hand.
Hey guys, sorry. I'm trying to get my internet to cooperate and it's not working well in either location.
We have a couple of answers here. I think a lot of us are in no. There is Larry who has worked with values in numerous organizations. And there is also Matthew who has mentioned that transitioning a call center based in Asia for a global audience, that's where he was able to use the culture framework.
Brilliant. Great. And I think you should see the poll up now.
Yeah, I just taken the poll. I think the poll is up now.
So we'll give it a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
Manju, have you ever used a values-based framework?
No, I haven't. I haven't had the opportunity to use it yet.
Okay. And if everybody's answered that.
Yeah, it's I think 50% or maybe more than that is largely no. However, we have Matthew who has had an experience of someone else using an instrument for value-based framework, for the culture framework.
Cool.
Okay, so David says that there, he has used it little in development context, but not in the ODE context. So yeah, we're excited in the ODE context.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I'm going to introduce you to one and then give you a case study. And I'd love, as Kathy mentioned, I'd love for you to... let me know how we could possibly use it inside of organizations. So that will be the exercise that comes a little bit later. I'm going to give you a whole lot of information now. So make sure you're relaxed and can see the screen.
There's some problem with Tanya's the internet connection.
Okay.
So she's just hoping to get it up and running.
Okay.
I think I'm back now, so I should be ready.
Yeah.
So are you going to play this now, Patricia, from yours?
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay, great. I'm going to see if I can do this. I have a pre-recording just so that I remember all of the details, but I'm going to see if I can do it without. And I'm hoping that Kathy and Manju will let me know if I miss out any information. But if there is any information that you have, any questions, then if you can just type them in the chat box and Manju will monitor that for us. Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's up to you. Now, Patricia, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but I just have to download it on my desktops because I changed computers, which would take about 1 minute. Do you prefer to do that or do you want to go ahead and run with it?
I think if we run with this now, Manju's given us some information on who has had one and who's worked with one and who hasn't. And then maybe we can look at the results at the end if we do have time.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, great. So in front of you here, you'll see a typology, and this is from Hofstede. So some of you have potentially seen this before. And the reason that I have Greece, India, and the US is because they form part of the case study. So Hofstede is not the only person who does a national cultural framework. There is Erin Meyer, there is Franz Trompenaars, there is Richard D. Lewis, for example. I chose Hofstede's one because I think three of his factors really hone in on things like hierarchy, decision-making, and leadership behavior, as well as organizational effectiveness. So if we take a look at his first factor is power distance. And this is the extent to which people accept and expect power to be distributed equally inside of a country. So when we look at the factor, we'll see United States is a low power distance score. So this really means that people question authority and there is some acceptance that power will be distributed among many people. If we take a look at India and Greece, which is above the mean, they have a high score. So hierarchy is clearly established here in these countries and it's unquestioned to a large extent. So that's the first factor of power distance. The second one is individualism versus collectivism. This really means the degree to which people in society are integrated and how they make decisions. So we'll see here that a high individualistic society such as the US, you potentially have loose ties around your acquaintances or friends, and you do business based on I rather than the collective we. When it comes to other countries like Greece or India, which is below the mean, they're more collective in the sense that their family is extended to extended families. There's a loyalty that's given to leaders, and leaders are there to ensure that they make the right decision on behalf of the group. So that's the second factor. And the third factor is uncertainty avoidance. And this is all about how much tolerance there is for ambiguity around laws and beliefs, etc. So you have a place like Greece, which has a high score, and that means that they typically have more stiff codes of behavior, more laws and regulations and guidelines around what behavior is appropriate. Whereas you get India and the US, which is below the mean. And so there is fewer regulations around what good behavior looks like. There's more ambiguity inside of environments, and it is more free flowing. So here we have really rich kind of data around how these different national cultural groups operate. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is setting the scene. And this is a consortium, three companies, India, Greece, and the US are building a major project out in the Middle East. The design is already in place, and so they take it on as the prime contractor. Now, the Greek company and the US company are part of a JV. And then your consortium, your third partner, which is your Indian company, is brought on to do all the MEP work, which is the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing services. So to some extent, the JV operates on a more integrated basis, and the third company has plans or standards, or their schedule is after the prime or the construction has taken place. These two companies, the Greek company and the US company, have other JV contracts in other parts of the world. So there's some emphasis around how they work together on this major project. And obviously that has implications for some of the other contracts that they do. So this is the scene. Mm-hmm. There are several reasons why this project is really complex. So they primarily take, these consortium partners take the way they function, their structure, all from their parent company, HQs, which are in different countries, of course. So what you'll get is the leadership style on project, but they're following the national cultural style. So your Greek leaders are very group oriented. Their decisions are not questioned, and there's a lot of loyalty given to what decisions they make. Whereas the US leadership style, they're more egalitarian, but more concentrated on the eye, they oriented that way. So the project information is obviously cascaded quite differently because of the structure. One company brings in all the software, the other company brings in all the procedures. But to a large extent, there is obvious in-group, out-group behavior, and that follows the national cultural lines. Another key element is that the project information is cascaded very differently between these two companies. So, sometimes they use different languages. So you might have English, but you might have another language in which they're problem solving, which means that oftentimes you don't understand what is being said about a particular issue. So all of this is taking place. It's quite a big thing. And then not uncommon for construction projects, they run into a little bit of an issue. There is a labor fatality. And then several months later, because morale has been severely impacted, it's quite low. There is a camp riot. And this camp riot is 600 laborers. The trigger is that they feel like one of the management companies injured one of their fellow workers. So they riot. And of course, this obviously incurs, you know, property damage to the vehicles, to the offices, and all the operational costs for 3 days of downtime. And that's up to the value of something like $60,000. You can tell that this was only a trigger event, and there must have been aspects that really impacted on the morale or the culture of the environment in order to reach this kind of point. This also means that there's scheduled delays that will follow, potentially because, you know, the client is part is inside of the Middle East. They have a big say in terms of how much visas they can allocate, how many people they allow into the country in order to work that schedule. And a little while later, in and amongst all of this going on, the JV partner walks off the contract, leaving another partner to kind of completely run the project. So, I mean, yeah, there's just things that escalate.
Are you there?
Yes. Manju, can you hear me? Okay, I'm going to keep on going ahead. So the reasons given for some of the issues that take place are that communication is really hampered between national cultural groups. And even though they have strict regulations for how they need to operate, potentially because of the different languages or because of the integration of the company, there's not a lot of communication that passes between people. So to some extent, this feels like a very fractured organization with no cohesive kind of leaders and no consensus on the way forward. More importantly, I guess, and a huge big industry concern is that the construction industry is felt to be very macho and aggressive anyway. So I'm going to ask you, if this was quite a lot of information, if you have any questions before we hop into the exercise.
I did want to ask, with a 2-year delay, did it ever get finished?
Matthew, it did eventually. Good question. Yes. Of course, lots of costs incurred by one party in order to get that finished.
Patricia, I had one question. Which member of the JV dropped out?
I can't disclose that to you, unfortunately.
Would it be helpful to maybe answer the role that that person was in? Are you thinking, Mike, that may have been an influence in the situation rather than the actual person?
So, yeah, I mean, it was one of the managing parties. It was one of the prime contractor companies. So it would have been a decision taken by the leadership of one of those groups. US, Greek, or Indian. Okay. Sorry, so, Mike.
In other words, Patricia, let me just for clarity. So it was like one of the national groups dropped out, is what you're saying.
It was one of the companies, but these companies are primarily divided by national cultural groups.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not giving you that information, Mike, only because I don't have permission to share that specific detail. Otherwise, I would, yeah. Okay. We're going to hop over to the exercise. And the exercise, potentially, we could have two groups rather than three. Tanya, I'm not sure how you feel about that.
I can edit it in a moment's notice. So
great.
Which two would you want to, right now we have three possible breakouts, power distance, individualism versus collectivism, and uncertainty avoidance. So how many, which one would you like to?
Can we go with power distance and individualism versus collectivism? So we're going to split you up into two groups, and I'm asking you the question, how does national culture influence organizational behavior? And if we can start to think of how do we develop organizations so that everybody inside of the group feels engaged and productive? So we're going to split you between power distance and individualism versus collectivism. If there's other details that you picked up that you want to add to the conversation, please go ahead. We're going to do a 15-minute discussion, and then we'll debrief.
It'll actually allow you to self-select the topic that you're most interested in. So I'm going to click a button here that'll open the breakout rooms, and you can choose which topic you would prefer to engage in. And then if for some reason you get into a space and you would want to hop into the other conversation, that allows you to switch between rooms, and you would do that down in the lower right corner of your screen where it would typically say leave, then you'll get into a leave or switch room option. Kathy did want me to remind everyone, if someone in the room might be willing to act as a scribe and be able to kind of capture some highlights of the conversation that could then be shared with the whole group when we come back together for a debrief. Anything else, or should I go ahead and open up the rooms?
Please go ahead, Tanya.
Should see on your screen the two rooms, and you just select the one you'd like to go into.
Group to just share what they discussed, any useful takeaways for the rest of us.
Our group talked about the importance of knowing the differences in advance going in, so that there could be an awareness of how the values in each group would conflict with the values of another group. So the idea being is awareness was the first step in terms of understanding what people were getting into, and then developing strategies and approaches for managing differences in a proactive way.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. That gap is quite big between the national cultures. I heard that you said that as well. I think especially with the power distance, somebody mentioned it's potentially not a short leap to figure out or to expect how to be treated by another management company, where those expectations are different.
I think one of the key things in our group talking about power distance index was it's quite a significant factor that plays into all sorts of things. And you know, the bottom line is the facilitation of meetings, of processes, of decisions, and so on can play a really important factor in avoiding problems. Otherwise, you know, all of the organization aspects that you might build in, like sort of modularity and making sure you've got touch points that are and handoffs that are minimizing the differences and feedback loops and so on. Well, all of those things might be fantastic, but if you're fundamentally not expecting or looking out for information and data from the other viewpoint, then it's still not really going to deliver anything for you.
Yeah, great. Thank you, David. It's interesting because, you know, a lot of these companies operate to ISO standards, so they do have lists of kind of regulations and things to follow, but they don't necessarily, or it hasn't been developed alongside a really culturally rich or diverse project. So I wonder how much of that, those requirements translate into another company, whether they actually know what it's there for or why, or can feed into that sort of system.
Monica had also suggested an approach. Monica, did you want to share about the survey and its use?
Yeah, sure. So I had an experience of leading change for a merger, which was a Japanese company taking over a Danish organization. And as you can clearly make out, the cultures are very different and there are stark differences. So one of the things we facilitated was a pre-survey in terms of understanding the difference in the value systems across different dimensions of leadership, how things get done, where are the decisions made, and so on and so forth. And that's exactly what Mike had summarized quite well, that helped us understand and get aware of where the differences are before really getting and setting up the organization for the future organization, setting up the model for the future organization. Because one of the things was in speaking to the leaders of both the management teams was that they knew there were differences, but the perception is very different from reality. And once it was on paper and we could show them where you see most of the differences, they were much aware. And we could draw out an action plan, which helped us in designing an organization structure of having a good representation from both the organizations across different levels, plus also working on a leadership development plan for them because they were two different styles of leadership. That eventually helped the organization build a lot of trust and collaboration, which is, as you're aware, always the key in success. And another point that came up while we were talking in our team was governance. In this particular case, we didn't need governance as such because it was a Japanese company and they're always really good in governance. But in others, mostly governance is an important factor because then people know where to go, what to do, because you've laid out, let's say, the matrix quite well, and there are guidelines of what to do when you reach this and where does the approval happen, so and so forth. So people are clear because we start with the context that nobody wants to do wrong. It's just that when they're not clear, wrong things happen, which may end up badly later.
There's some great points. Thank you, Monica. And I love the way that you use this framework prior to constructing anything inside of the organization. And I wonder if anybody else has seen that before, or if you think that it would be something we'd have to do as OD specialists now that companies are becoming more global.
I have seen a little bit of that in terms of mergers and acquisition from when I worked at Abbott Labs. When Abbott would consider a partner early in the process, they would sort of do a cultural assessment and proactively identify where the potential sources of conflict might be, so that as the management teams were working together, they could be aware of it and proactively plan for those issues.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mike. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. I can just comment briefly on this. I spent a lot of my career doing this type of work with project teams, some leadership teams in merger situations where the companies did have the understanding that cross-cultural differences were going to really make a difference in their ability to get the work done, to complete a project, to complete a merger. And it took really intensive work with coaching the leaders around leadership, cross-cultural issues, and organization design, but also working with the teams themselves on building awareness on values differences and actually doing an action learning project, for example, strategic planning or other projects where they would be over a long period of time working those issues through to get the practice in how to not only raise their awareness, but also work and manage those differences so they could learn to listen to one another and manage these. I think the more complex and interesting problem comes into play when you're designing structures and processes from a design standpoint where you can have the flexibility to enable these cultural differences to show themselves, but also to be resolved. And I think that that's one of the things that I find most interesting about working with global organizations and org design. And I don't have the answers to that, but I think that to me is the interesting question.
One of the experiences I had at Abbott was very interesting. They were acquiring startup companies that were about to go to scale. So Abbott acted as an early investor in the companies, and they would put someone from their finance team there, and the finance guy would flag and say, here's, we're supporting this startup. They're ready to go to scale. We think we have the product ready to go to scale. And for the very reasons we were acquiring that particular company, its entrepreneurial spirit and some of its key cultural advantages, a decision was made was not to integrate them totally into Abbott, which Abbott felt would destroy what made them the acquisition unique. And they actually designed them in a space of their own so that the dominant culture at Abbott would not crush the entrepreneurial spirit of the startup that we were acquiring. So very interesting to see how people responded to the org design decision in terms of preserving what they were acquiring.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, Mike. And my experience in the M&A sort of world would certainly say that people are much more alive to cultural mismatch and as you say, not wanting to squash the what they've just bought and squeeze all the value out by mistake. I guess to my mind, there's so much in the intercompany cultural difference and then overlay and process differences and all of that sort of stuff, that it's difficult to see whether national culture adds to the, let's say, the analysis and working through of that, or it just gets lost in the mix of all of the other differences. You know, I think it's a useful introduction to the, to the whole topic, but I think it probably quite quickly goes on to the other factors of difference. In my experience,
reading this case initially made me ask the question: why didn't they do something in advance? So in our group, we discussed about writing it into a project charter and establishing, a pre-agreement set of a working agreement beforehand. So unfortunately, a couple projects I've more recently been either bidding on or called on to where those where a previous organization had failed, the consultant had failed, and they wanted us to come in midstream and sort of sort out the mess. So that's just like an alternate to the ideal case where we can establish an agreement beforehand.
Patricia, do you have any, can you share insights on, we have about 5 minutes on what actually happened?
I do have a slide. Let me pick that up. There wasn't a lot of pre-work that was done on the national cultural differences. And I think the plenty with these large, the way they're tended for, sometimes can be really quick and rough and ready, or concentrated on the finance aspect of it. So there wasn't a lot done around the national cultural differences. Both companies had sort of best practices, but and also very experienced people, but I don't know that the national cultural differences, potentially this was the first time some of them worked in this sort of environment, so they didn't quite realize the degree of difference. What subsequently happened with all of this, and it was very interesting. There was workshops with leaders across the consortium. This was before one of the joint venture partners worked off, but a charter was built with the OD team. The OD team wouldn't be contracted to do work on a permanent basis. They were just part of HQ. So they would come in and then do something and then leave. It really looked like there was communication issues. And so there's an awful lot of meetings that were then constructed afterwards. So like camp labor meetings between management and laborers, just to air issues. In the labor group, there was a huge amount of people. So they would inevitably have kind of like the chief of the dormitory or, you know, the chief of the team who potentially wasn't a team leader, but had some say in terms of what it is that was happening. And that seemed to be a more of a cultural, national cultural piece that we didn't quite understand. But there was meetings to ensure that they were able to bring up issues to project management team, more of an emphasis around some of the leadership styles, being able to flex, have a degree of flexibility to them. So where they knew that people wanted communication and they would engage in doing that more regularly. There was training, there was OD, there was a lot of work done between the staff members because there was a young group of people. This potentially added to the complexity, but also there needed to be some sort of communal integration rather than integration just in terms of organizational structure. So there's all sorts of things done so that this was possible. But of course, the hours worked on a major project is huge. So you're always working, usually. After the JV partner walked off, this was very interesting because one of those partners had all of the software or had all of the procedures. So when all of that went away, then there was a huge rush to ensure that we have systems and we have processes in place in order to continue. Of course, you never want to be in that situation, but It was all remedial, and there was obviously a lot of work then done with a client to ensure that the client remained satisfied that the work could, in fact, get done. I think management then just increased their eyes on supply chain, increased their eyes on kind of any sort of subcontractors that came in, any of the management around subcontractors, because they were pushed at this stage. Around the research itself, I was looking at organizational diagnostics and seeing if OD models actually have an element of national culture or external environments that they bring in order to understand how to design the organization. Because I think a lot of the OD models were developed kind of a couple of years back, I don't know that they emphasize national culture to the degree that's necessary for the way we work now and the kind of globalization, the rapid rate in change in technology that we're experiencing now. So that was the, that has been the research that's looking at an organizational diagnostic to see how we can pinpoint if there are going to be issues further down the line and how we can do pre-work at the planning stage of a project. I think if anybody wants to share or have this conversation with me, I'd love to hear from you. So I'm gonna just give you my email address.
I dropped it in the chat just a moment ago there, Patricia, too. So.
Thank you for all of your comments. Really enjoyed the conversation. And I would love to chat directly to you if you have more questions around it or if I can give you more information on what was done.
Thank you so much, Patricia. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks all. Good session. Appreciate it.